beating wings brought her closer and closer. She cawed a greeting and then landed solidly on Purr's arm.
"Tired," she said. "So tired."
She walked up his shoulder to nestle under his chin. "I swear, sometimes I am certain she knows every word we say," I observed.
"Every word," she repeated,
and regarded me with one bright eye. I stared at her. The tip of her beak was silver.
"Purr," I warned him, trying to keep my voice calm. "Keep her away from your face. She has silver on her beak."
I saw the boy freeze. Then he said in a shaky voice,
"I can't sense magic at all. Maybe I'm immune to silver, too."
"And maybe you're not. Please, move her away from your throat." He lifted his wrist, and the bird transferred herself to his hand.
"What did you do?"
he asked her.
"How did you get silver on your beak, pretty thing? Are you all right? Do you feel ill?"
In response, she turned and groomed her flight feathers. They did not go silver, but they sheened blacker than I'd ever seen them.
"Hebe," she croaked. "Hebe share. Hebe teach how."
Ah, Rabscal's tonic back at Divitown. I should have guessed. And was her time with the dragons improving her speech? "Be careful with your beak," I chided her. She turned her shining eyes on me.
"I am careful, stupid Fitz, but so tired. Take me to Paragon."
She clambered up Perth's sleeve to his shoulder again and gave me a baleful look before closing her eyes. I heard Trell roaring at us to get a move on and stop perching like seagulls. Purr looked to me, ignoring his captain.
"Do I take her to Paragon?"
"I doubt you can keep her away, and no matter how careful she is, I want you to be even more careful. Warn any others that she might fly to." Brashen roared again, and Purr began his hasty descent, shouting that Motley had returned. As Purr spidered and slid with the bird on his shoulder, Spark crossed the deck at a run. I began my more cautious descent.
"Are you truly a prince?"
Kennetson asked as I paused beside him. I hesitated for a moment. Bastard or prince? Dutiful had made me a prince. "I am," I said quietly, "but due to illegitimacy, not in line for the throne." He shrugged that aside.
"That lad, that Purr, he was your stable boy?"
"Yes."
"You work alongside him, and he never defers to you at all?"
"He does, but not in a noticeable way, I suppose. He respects me, even if others don't see it."
"Huh."
The sound was thoughtful rather than disdainful. Even a short time on board as a common sailor had changed him. He was clever enough to know that if he was quartered with common deckhands, such as Ant and Purr, he'd best step down from his elevated ways. He had shed his fine clothes and adopted the same loose canvas trousers and cotton shirts that the rest of us wore. He'd braided his hair and tied it after Ant had warned him about how loose locks of hair could get tangled around a moving line and be ripped right off the scalp. He'd also bound the palms of his hands with leather. I suspected bloody blisters on them. Hemp lines are not gentle to handle. He said no more to me, so I hastened down to await my next order. It had been decades since I'd worked the deck of a ship, and never had I toiled on one like Paragon. The living nature of the ship meant that he could be an active participant in the journey. He could not set his own canvas or take it in, but he could cry a better heading to the steersman, sense where currents ran swiftest, and warn us of a line that needed tightening. He had a fine sense of depths and channels, something that he had proudly demonstrated as he guided his crew out of the harbour at Divitown, and that he did again now as we sailed cautiously through the waterways of the pirate islands and finally into the open sea. As he sliced through the taller waves, our diminished crew strove to keep pace with his needs. I was not alone in marvelling at the ways of a live ship. The crew members we had taken on in Divitown were openly delighted with how Paragon participated in his sailing. Before long, the navigator was humbly asking permission to share her charts with the figurehead and correcting them according to his knowledge. Given his way, Paragon himself became almost affable, and especially so with Boyo and Kennetson. Even so, my transition from passenger to deckhand was not easy. I had always harbored a secret pride in how able I had remained into my seventh decade. Much of my physical strength I owed to the old skill healing that still coursed through my body and made unceasing repairs to it. But healthy is not necessarily hardened. Those first days were long ones for me. The calluses earned by wielding a sword or an axe are different from the rough palms that prickling hemp lines award to a sailor. In the rigorous days that followed, I ached in my legs and my back and my arms. Muscle in my limbs and a flattened belly came back to me slowly. My body healed itself, but healing can be as painful as being injured. Despite the men we had gained in Divitown, we still had a smaller crew and fewer who were used to sailing a live ship. The end of my watch was no guarantee of uninterrupted rest. A cry for "All hands!" might come at any moment. As Brashen had foretold, there was no friendly current to aid us in our southeastern journey. Land became a smear of low cloud on the horizon behind us. When I woke the next day, it was gone. Spark and Purr both thrived. They scampered happily about in the rigging with Ant. Clef was a good teacher, and now they had Boyo as well, an experienced hand. Lant labored alongside me, trying to teach his man's body the skills it would have been happier to acquire as a boy. I pitied him, but he did not complain. All of us ate as heavily as we were allowed and took sleep whenever we could. There was a hearty rhythm to the days. If I had been younger and had no other goal in life than to earn my bread, it would have been satisfying. The animosity of the live ship's crew over how we would destroy the life they had always known was ground away in the day-by-day necessity of working alongside us. I avoided any topic that might remind them that. At the end of this journey, Paragon intended to become dragons. I marveled at Brashen's patience with Kennetson. More than once, the captain had paired me with him. Prince Fitzchivalry, Brashen always called me, and I finally grasped that he was making the boy see that even a royal prince did not hesitate to apply himself to the humblest task. But ultimately, I think Kennetson strove for the skills of a sailor not from Trell's orders, but from his own desire to be seen as equal or better at his duties than any of the deckhands. It was painful to watch. He would race a more experienced hand to a task and loudly exclaim, "I can do it!" He sometimes scorned offers of help and corrections to his methods. He was not a stupid man, but he was overly proud and desperate to be right. Even more painful was seeing Boyo caught between his parents and the man he wished to be friends with. Kennetson treated Boyo as if he were an affable puppy, sometimes showing scorn of the younger man's maritime skills. I sometimes saw Boyo surreptitiously recoil a line in Kennetson's wake, or loose a line and re-knot it. I said nothing, but I was certain that if I was aware of it, his father certainly was. And if Brashen was letting it go by, it was not up to me to say anything. Still, it was darkly fascinating to watch Kennetson seesaw between a man eager to learn the skills and a prince who could not admit that he did not know something. I hoped for no disasters. Clef, the first mate, had seen Boyo raised from infancy, and it was natural the two would be close, so I was surprised when he befriended Kennetson. Clef had been a youngster on Paragon in the days when Kennet had raped Althea and tried to send Paragon to the bottom, yet he seemed to take Kennetson on his own merits. And when I observed Clef correct Kennetson, the prince seemed better able to accept criticism than when Brashen intervened. I also feared that Purr might be jealous over losing Clef's attention, but instead he attached himself to the group, and soon they began to sit together at meals. When Purr joined the three of them at dice one evening, I knew he had been accepted into that circle, and I let go of him. Boys seek out what they need. Over the course of a few evenings, I saw Kennetson move from ignoring Purr to the mockery and teasing that prelude true friendship. I watched Kennetson and Purr conspire to merrily cheat Boyo at cards until he had lost every dry bean they were using in lieu of coins. Boyo's mock outrage when he discovered the ploy completed Purr's initiation into that group. Clef began to pair Kennetson with Purr for some of his duties. More than once, I saw Purr showing the prince the proper way to perform a task. They became friends, and I judged it good for both of them. But it was not without missteps. I stood aside when Boyo and Kennetson undertook to get Purr well and truly drunk. Every young man must pass that trial, and I judged that while he would suffer the next day, he would take no real harm from it. Boyo especially had a heart for mischief rather than petty cruelty. What I had not counted on was that Purr would, in his inebriation, invite them to our cabin to see the wonderful elderling gifts the Rainwilders had given us. When I chanced to step in, all three were well soused, and my lad was holding up one of Shade's firepots and trying to explain what he thought it was. The elderling brick was upside down on my bunk, and the blanket had begun to smoulder. That did not upset me as much as seeing Bee's books in proximity to the scorched blanket. I drove all three out of the cabin with some colourful curses and a solid kick to the rump for Purr. He apologised profusely the next day, between bouts of vomiting over the railing, and Boyo and Kennetson both offered their contrition more sedately later. It cemented a bond of friendship among the three, and I felt that Purr was now as safe aboard the Paragon as anyone could be. Spark came to wake me from much-needed sleep to summon me to Amber's cabin one evening. I went bleary-eyed. The hard physical labor of being a sailor took a toll on me every day. "It's important," she hissed at me before wending her way like a cat between the hammocks of the other sailors. I arrived at the cabin to find Purr already there, looking as befuddled as I felt. I was relieved to see that I was meeting with the fool and not Amber.
"We need to discuss our plans for rescuing Bee," he announced.
"You are certain that she's alive?" Purr asked. His hunger for confirmation made me cringe.
"I am," the fool asserted softly. "I know it is hard for you to believe, after we set out solely with vengeance in mind, but I am certain she lives, and that changes all our plans."
Purr gave me a sidelong, doubtful glance that I was glad the fool could not see. I kept my features grave and still. "You have all studied the map the fool made. It is essential that you have at least that much knowledge of the layout of Clary's castle." They nodded, and Spark confirmed aloud,
"We have." "I've told you that the only way to get into the castle is at low tide, when we will join a crowd of folk who will have paid dearly for the privilege of crossing. I will be well disguised, lest any recall me. We will think of roles for you."
I caught my breath before I sighed. I still felt a solo venture in to set some poison or cut a few throats was my best route.
"Once we are inside, we must break away from the main flow of petitioners and conceal ourselves. We may have to separate to do so. Keep in mind that Bee does not know me or Spark. So after nightfall, when we convene in the deserted washing court, we must form two parties. Fitz and Purr will be one. Lant, Spark, and I are the other. Thus each party has a competent warrior and someone who can open a locked door."
He smiled in Spark's general direction. "Worse and worse." I said nothing. Lant was looking at his hands. Purr was listening intently. Spark seemed to have already been a party to this plan, for she looked unsurprised.
"There are at most four places that Bee may be. On the roof of the stronghouse, the old harem quarters have been converted to cells for valuable prisoners who must be punished but not permanently harmed. She may be there, or in the cottages where the whites are stabled.
I knew what his next words would be, and dreaded hearing them.
But there are also two levels below the castle. In the first one, there are cells with stone floors and iron bars, little light and harsh conditions. I dread she may be there.
He drew a breath.
On the lowest level are the worst cells, and the place where torment is deliberate and prolonged. There the waste of the castle flows into an open basin, and then out to the sea. There is no light, and the air stinks of excrement and death. That is the worst possible place she might be, and therefore it is the first place I must search for her. My party will begin at the lowest level. Fitz and Purr will go to the rooftop cells. If you find her there, go to the washing court. If not, check the cottages.
Purr opened his mouth to speak. A motion of my hand silenced him.
Whether or not you find her in the cottages, go to the washing court.
He drew breath.
After we have searched the cells, we will also search for the entry to the tunnel that my rescuers used to extricate me. If we are successful and we have found B, two of us will immediately take B out that way. One of us will meet you in the washing court to let you know where we have gone and guide you to the tunnel.
What if we don't find the entrance to the tunnel? Lent asked.
We will bring extra garments for B, perhaps the butterfly cloak. We will again conceal ourselves, and the next day we will emerge to mingle with the petitioners and leave with them as they flow out in a crowd.
His hands, one gloved and one bare, clutched each other. He knew how bad his plan was. I didn't need to tell him. It was the desperate plotting of a man who longed for something to be so.
What if we don't find her?
Purr asked in a faltering voice.
Again we hide and leave with the tide of petitioners the next day. That may happen, for my dreams do not tell me if she has already arrived in Clarice or is simply travelling there. We may have to wait.
And the dragons? Lent asked. Tintaglia and Hebe both seemed intent on their vengeance. What if they arrive at Clara's before we do? The fool's clutching hands rose to his collar and clung there. He licked his lips.
I must trust that my dreams would show me such a disastrous event. As of yet, they have not, and so I have hope.
He gave a quick shake of his head as if to dash Lent's question from his mind.
Does everyone understand the part they are to play? Are we agreed?
I did not nod, but no one seemed to notice that. Spark spoke for the others.
We all do, and now perhaps you can sleep.
He rubbed his face with both hands, and I saw what had escaped me before. He was boiling with anxiety. It took every bit of Shade's training for me to put warmth and certainty into my voice. Go to sleep, old friend. Purr and I must return to our hammocks, for our watch begins soon. We should all rest while we can.
While we can,
he agreed, and Spark nodded to me as we left the small cabin. Lant walked with us as Purr and I headed back toward our hammocks. When we were well away from the fool's door, Lant caught at my sleeve to halt me. Do you believe B is still alive? He asked in a low voice. Purr stepped closer to hear my reply. I chose my words carefully. The fool does. He makes a plan that puts finding her first. I am happy to follow it. That was a lie. I added, it does not interfere with my own plans to take the lives of those who took her from me. And so we parted. I returned to my hammock, but could not find sleep again. Day after long day, the horizon did not change. Water was all I could see when I went to sleep at the end of my watch, and when I arose to my duties. The weather held fine and grew warmer. We all browned in the sun, except for Lady Amber, who remained a very pale gold, darker than the fool had been, but much lighter than Nord Golden. Once the fool had told me that it was believed that as white prophets succeeded in their tasks, they would shed skin and become darker. He had become paler, and I wondered if it meant that the servants had thwarted him in his goals. Lady Amber did what tasks she could, from scrubbing the turnips and potatoes to splicing lines. She ungloved her silver fingers for that task, and the rope seemed to obey and merge where she directed it. It reminded me uncomfortably of Verity smoothing the stone of his dragon, and I avoided watching her at that task. Amber spent more time with Paragon than either of our captains would have preferred. Paragon welcomed her, and often Kennetson and Boyo joined her when she played music for him. Motley also spent a great deal of time with Paragon. Between my duties and Amber's time with the ship, I saw little of the fool, and I had little opportunity to worry about how aloof she had become. Our progress was slow. The currents of the ocean did not favor us. The weather was kind, but the winds were inconstant. On some days, the wind slept and the canvas hung nearly limp. Sometimes, looking at the endless water, I wondered if we moved at all. The farther south we went, the warmer the days grew. Summer was upon us, and light lingered long in the evenings. One such day, I retired early to my bunk and closed my eyes. I was both weary and bored, but sleep eluded me. I tried to do as my wolf had taught me, center myself in the now and refuse to worry about the future or dwell on the past. It had never been easy for me, and that afternoon was no exception. As I lay still, hoping for sleep to find me, a whisper of skill came to me. Tar? I sat up straight, startled, and lost the contact. No, no. Lie down. Be very still. Breathe slow and deep. And wait. Wait. It was like watching a game trail from up in a tree. Wait. Tar! Can you sense me? It's Nettle. I got your bird, and I have news for you. Tar? I took slow, deep breaths and tried to stay balanced on the knife's edge between sleep and wakefulness. I ventured into the skill current. It seemed weaker, almost elusive. Nettle, I am here. Is all well with you and your child? A shiver went through me. Nettle's child. My grandchild, banished from my mind for all these weeks. Not yet, but soon. Her response was a whisper on the wind, but with it came a warm thread of her pleasure that my first thought had been for her and the child. Soft as thistledown, her words floated to me. Your bird message reached us, but I did not fully understand. We have sent Lady Rosemary as an emissary there. Why did you wish skill healers to go to Kelsingra? I believe it would benefit all. I opened my mind to her and shared my pity for the dragon-touched folk there. I added it to my practicality. An unshakable alliance could be formed with these peoples, and possibly we would gain a greater understanding of the skill if we had access to Kelsingra and all that the skill had wrought there. I tempered it with a warning about dragon silver and my conviction that it was the same stuff that Verity had slathered onto his hands so that he could finish his stone dragon. Incredibly powerful and dangerous stuff. Do not let Shade get wind of it, or he will long to experiment with it. How is Shade? I miss him, and so does Lant. Hush! Think not his name. Her warning was too late. I felt a ripple of something, like a breeze that stirs the canvas before the wind hits a sail fully. Then shade swept into my mind, obliterating me. He was mad, triumphantly so, and ecstatic with skill.
Fitz!
He boomed my identity out into the skill current. As if he had violently stirred a pot of water, I felt that the skill whirled and drenched me.
There you are, my boy! I've missed you so! Come with me! I've so much to show you!
Dutiful! Coteries all! To me! To me! Contain Lord Shade! Contain him!
I was ripped out of myself, torn from my body. My mind spread as thin as spilled wine on a table. I was a flurry of snowflakes scattered by the wind, the dispersing fog of breath on an icy night. I heard distant cries and shouts and sensed a struggle somewhere. Then, as clear as a drop of icy water on the back of my neck, I felt the uncertain touch of another mind.
Da? Are you a dream? Da?
I had never touched minds with B in the skill stream. I did not hear her voice. I did not see her face. But the touch of her thoughts was so uniquely B that I could have no doubt it was her. It was feeble and thin, a child's voice shouting into strong wind over water. I reached for her.
B, is it you? Are you alive? Da, where are you? Why didn't you come for me? Da.
B, where are you?
My first desperate question.
On a ship, bound for Clarys. Da. They are cruel to me. Please help me. Why don't you come for me?
Then, like a great sweeping wind, shade blasted through my thoughts, scattering me.
B? Does she skill, then? My daughter skills, my shine does. She is strong in the skill, but they keep her from me.
Da, da.
Shade was a roaring wind, catching and scattering smaller skill entities in his tumultuous passage. I feared B would be tossed and broken, torn to shreds in any encounter. I shoved her away.
B, flee, wake up. Turn away, break clear, get away, don't touch your mind to mine.
Ta?
She clung to me, desperate and afraid. There was no time to reassure her. I pushed her then, hard, as if I pushed her out of the path of a runaway horse. I felt her fear and hurt, but I tore myself clear of her reaching thought and engaged Shade to prevent him from scorching her.
Shade, stop, you are too strong. You will sear all of us to nothing, as Verity burned out poor August. Take control of your skill. Shade, please. You too, Fitz. Will you suppress me as well? Traitor! You are heartless. This is my magic, my birthright, my glory. Then pour it down his throat if you must. Quickly. Three of the apprentices are having seizures.
That was Nettle. At a great distance, both shouting and skilling with all her strength. I sensed Shade's anger and hurt that we were conspiring against him. We had all turned on him, he was certain of it, because we were jealous of his magic and wanted all his secrets. None of us had ever truly loved him, not one of us, except for Shine. As abruptly as a curtain dropping at the end of the puppet show, all was gone. There was no roaring skill from Shade, no whisper from Nettle. And worst of all, when I groped for B's uncertain skilling, I found nothing. Nothing at all. I found I was on the floor, beside my bunk. Tears were streaming unchecked down my cheeks. She was out there, my B, tossed and torn in a storm of skill, captured and treated badly. The fool had been right all along. I could not give up. I plunged in again, sieving the skill current for her, over and over until I felt my strength failing. When I came back to my surroundings, I was curled in a ball. My body ached and my head pounded. Old. I felt 100 years old. I had failed and abandoned not only my child, but also my old mentor. I spared a thought for him. Shade. Poor old Shade, lost in the magic that he had so longed for. Now it mastered him, and he rode it as one rode a runaway steed. We had hurt him tonight, and I knew it was not the first time he had felt abandoned and persecuted. I wished I could be there to sit by his bed and take his hand and assure him that, yes, he was loved and had always been loved. His hunger for that had burned me almost as much as his wild skilling. But as fiercely as I longed to be with Shade, my anxiety for Bee consumed me. On a ship, she had said, bound for Clarez. Alive. Absolutely alive. In a terrible situation, but alive, and wondering why I had not come to save her. Her captors were cruel to her, but she lived. The amazement of that echoed through me like bells ringing. The surging joy of being certain she had survived collided with my terrible fears for her. How had she managed all those months alone with her captors? It burned that I had pushed her away when she reached for me. But alive, indubitably alive. That knowledge was air in my lungs, water after drought. I pulled myself to my feet. She was alive. I had to share the news with the fool. Our primary quest was now her rescue. And then bloody vengeance on those who had kept her from me.
I already told you she was alive.
I was still shaking, still breathing hard from my rush through the ship to find the fool. To have Lady Amber be so dismissive of my news was maddening. This is different, I asserted. You had a dream that might or might not have indicated that Bee was alive. I felt her skill. She spoke to me. I know she is alive, on her way to Clarys, and treated poorly by those who hold her captive. Amber smoothed her skirts. I had found her standing at the railing, staring blindly out over the side of the ship. Waves slapped against us, but I saw no sign we were moving. My need for the ship to be moving, to be pounding his way through waves toward Clarys, was a pain in my chest. Amber glanced at me, empty-eyed, and then turned her face to the sea.
As I told you, weeks ago, months ago, before we ever left Buck Keep, I urged you to rush to Clarys. Had you heeded me, we would be there now, awaiting her arrival. Everything would have been different. Everything.
There was no ignoring the sharp rebuke in her tone. She spoke as if she were the fool, but she was not. I stood for a time, simply looking at her. I was on the point of simply walking silently away when she spoke again, very quietly.
It tires me and it annoys me. All my life, people have doubted that I was the true White Prophet. But you are my catalyst. You have seen what we have done. You took me to the door of death and drew me back again. I do not deny that my powers are greatly diminished. Even my vision of this world is light and shadow. But when I tell you that my dreams have returned, when I say I have dreamed a thing and it is so or will be so, Fitz, you of all people should not doubt me. If I were to say that I doubted the truth of your skilling, if I claimed you had merely had a dream, would you not be annoyed?
I suppose so, I conceded. It was a sharp slap that she would not share my joy in finally being certain, but only rebuked me for my doubts. I wished I had not hurried to her, wished I had kept my news to myself. Could she not understand how dangerous it felt to believe that my child was alive? How I feared the fall from such a high hope. Could she not grasp now how painfully I soared, knowing Bee was alive and fearing for her situation? The fool would have understood that. I was abruptly taken aback at how odd a thought that seemed. Were the Fool and Amber truly so separate in my thoughts? Yes, they were. Amber had never saved Ketrickan, or carried me on her back through a snowy night. She'd never known Night Eyes. She'd never been tortured and maimed, never served King Shrewd through danger and treachery. I clenched my teeth. What exactly did I share with this Amber? Very little, I decided. She was merciless as she continued.
If you had believed me, we would be there, watching and waiting. We would be in a position to recover her before they could take her into their stronghold. As it is, we must wonder now, are they before us? Are they behind us?
I tried to find an argument to make her wrong, but I could not. Her rebuke was too stabbing an attack. I had not shared with her that Shade had been on a skill rampage and that Nettle and her coteries seemed barely able to contain one old man, and I decided I would not. I straightened from leaning on the railing. I'm going to get some sleep, I told her. Later, perhaps, when he was the Fool, I'd share my skill fears and my agony of worry for B. Later, I might tell him how I had pushed her away, out of Shade's path, but also away from me. I had come to Amber full of exhilaration from my contact with B, and devastation that I could not sustain it or find her, but now I had no one to share that storm of emotions. I could not speak to Lant without tormenting him about the state of his father. I did not wish Spark to worry for Shade. Right now, I did not wish to supply Amber with any new quarrels to shoot at me.
Walk away,
Amber said in a small, deadly voice.
Walk away, Fitz, from things you don't want to hear, things you don't want to feel, things you don't want to know.
I had halted at her first words, but as she continued, I did as she suggested. I walked away. She lifted her voice to call after me, her words freighted with anger.
Would that I could walk away from what I know. Would that I could choose to disbelieve my dreams.
I kept walking. A ship never truly sleeps. Always there are sailors on watch and all must be ready to leap to the deck at a moment's notice. But I was deeply asleep when someone shook my shoulder, and I came up ready to fight. By the hooded light of a dimmed lantern, I saw Spark regarding me with a mixture of alarm and amusement. What? I demanded, but she shook her head and motioned that I should follow her. I rolled quietly from my hammock and threaded my way through sleeping sailors. We emerged onto the deck. The wind was slight, the waves calm. Overhead, the stars were close and bright. The moon appearing. I hadn't bothered with a shirt or shoes, but the air was so balmy, I didn't miss them. Is something wrong? I asked Spark.
Yes.
I waited.
I know you thought less of me for bringing the book to Amber, for spying on you to see where you kept it, and you had the right to be distrustful of me. When last I tried to speak of this to you, you made it clear you did not wish to know any secrets. Well, now I come to betray trust to you again, and I expect your opinion of me will be even lower. I cannot keep this secret any longer.
My heart sank into the pit of my stomach. My thoughts immediately leapt to her and Lant, and I dreaded what she might tell me.
It's Amber, she said in a whisper.
I drew breath to tell her that I did not wish to know any of Amber's secrets. Amber's anger was a wall I did not want to breach. I felt both sullen and sulky about it. If Amber had a secret she did not wish to share with me, but told Spark, well, then they were both welcome to keep it to themselves. But Spark didn't care if I wanted to know or not. She spoke quickly.
She dreams your death. When we were on the river, it was only once, at most twice, but now it is almost every night. She talks and cries out warnings to you in her sleep, and wakes up shaking and weeping. She does not speak of it to me, but I know,
for she talks in her sleep. The sun will die. How can the sun die? It must not be. There must be another path, another way. But if there is, I do not think she can find it. It's destroying her. I do not know why she does not tell you of her nightmares.
Did you leave her just now? Does she know you've come to me? Spark shook her head to both questions.
Tonight, she seems to sleep well. Even when she wakes weeping, I feign sleep. The one time I tried to help her, she told me not to touch her and to leave her alone.
She looked at the deck.
I don't want her to know that I told you this.
She won't, I promised. I wondered if or how I would let the fool know that I knew.
He had told me that the more often something was dreamed, the likelier it was. During our years together, he had often helped me dodge deaths. I recalled how he had summoned Burrick to the top of the tower on the evening Galen had beaten me. Together, they had drawn me back from the edge where I had crawled, inspired by Galen to hurl myself down. He'd warned me of a poisoning in the mountain kingdom, carried me on his back to safety when I'd been felled by an arrow. He'd often told me that in his dreams my survival was so unlikely as to be nearly impossible, but he had to keep me alive at any cost so that I could help him change the world. And we'd accomplished that. He'd dreamed his own certain death, and together we had defied that. I believed his dreams. I had to, except when they were too terrifying to believe. And then I always pretended I could defy them. And now he dreamed my death. Again. Or did he? Was I still the unexpected son in his visions? Or was B? Did we hurtle toward a rescue that he believed could not succeed? I felt supremely unmoved at the thought of my own death. If my death was the price of rescuing B, I'd pay it, and gladly. And I was suddenly relieved to think that Lant and the Fool would be there to take her safely back to Buckkeep. I knew that Riddle and Nettle would take her in and probably do a far better job of raising her than I could. But if he dreamed we would reach Clarez only to have her snatched away into death, no, I would not, could not, believe it. I would not allow that to be. Was that what had made Amber so callous when I shared my news? Did she now believe that Bea lived, but would not survive to be rescued? No, it had to be me. I was the unexpected son, not B. Please, Ida and L, not B. Spark was still staring at me, her face pale in the starlight. It's not the first time he has dreamed me dead, I told her. I managed a crooked smile. Remember, when he is the prophet, I am the catalyst, the changer. I have no intention of dying or letting anyone else die. Go back to sleep, Spark. Rest while you can. What is to be, or may not. She stood silent, and I saw a battle waged inside her. She lifted her eyes to meet mine and added defiantly, "She sees more than she admits to you." I nodded to that. "He always has," I told her, and turned away from her. I let my gaze wander back over the water. After a time, I heard her light footsteps bear her away. I let out my pent-up sigh. I wished it were all over, all the doubts and uncertainties finished. They wearied me more than any axe fight. I wanted to be finished with waiting and preparing. Yet the waters stretched endlessly before me like crumpled paper under the uncertain moonlight. Somewhere upon those waters, another ship moved, toward Clarez, with my daughter aboard. Before us? Behind us? I had no way of knowing. Chapter 22. The Butterfly Cloak. Wasps sting when their nest is threatened. I went to fetch a clay flower pot for my mother. I took one from the top of the stack, not knowing that wasps had built a nest between it and the one below. They rushed out in a horde and chased me as I fled. They stung me over and over, and the pain was like fire eating into my flesh. They are not like bees, who must weigh an attack against their own lives. Wasps are more like men, able to kill again and again, and still go on living. My cheek and neck were swollen, and my hand was a shapeless lump with sausage fingers. My mother put the sap of ferns and cool mud on the stings, and then took oil and a flame and killed them all, burning their nest and their unhatched children in vengeance for what they had done to her daughter. This was before I could speak clearly. I was astonished at her hatred of them. Truly, I had not known my mother capable of such cold anger. When I stared at her, as the nest burned, she nodded to me. "While I live, no one shall hurt you and go unpunished for it." I knew then I must be careful of what I told her about the other children. My father may once have been an assassin. My mother remained one. B. Farseer's Journal. There are so many songs about sailing off the edge of the world. Some say one goes over an immense waterfall and reaches a land of gentle and wise people and strange animals. In other tales, the sailors reach a land of intelligent talking animals who find humans disgusting and rather stupid. The one I liked best was the tale of sailing off all known charts and finding a place where you are still a child, and you can speak with the child and warn him to make better choices. But on this voyage, I had begun to feel that when one sailed off the edge of the world, one entered a realm of endless work and boredom and the same watery horizon every day. The reality of sailing off the edge of all known charts was that one man's unknown territory was another man's pond. Paragon asserted that he had been to Clarys and the adjacent islands when he was Igrot's ship, and that even Kennet had been there as a boy. Igrot had been obsessed with fortune-tellers and omens, a trait that some stories said had been passed on to Kennet. The crew we had taken on in Divitown included a competent navigator. She had never sailed to Clarys, but had a chart from her grandfather. She was a seasoned deckhand, and as the trade routes familiar to Althea and Brashen were lost in the distance, she spent most of her time with them. Nightly, they consulted the stars, and she called a course to Paragon, and most nights, he confirmed it. The slow days melted one into another. There were minor diversions. One day, when there was no wind to speak of, Clef brought out a pipe and whistled us up a wind. If it was magic, it was a kind that I could not feel and had never seen before. I pretended it was coincidence. Per got a splinter in his foot and it became infected. Althea helped me draw it out and treated it with two herbs I didn't know. He was given a day to rest. Motley had become an accepted member of the crew. Any moment when she was not with Per or Amber, she spent with Paragon. She rode on the figurehead's shoulder, or even on top of his head. When the winds were good and he cut through the waves, she flew before him. The sad thing about boredom is that one learns to value it only when it is exploded by a disaster, or the threat of one. I witnessed the changing relationships among our crew members from a distance, watching the tensions that any long voyage or campaign brings. I hoped to see those interior storms break apart and pass us by, yet one afternoon, as I worked alongside Lant, mending a sail, he said to me the words I had dreaded. "Kennetson likes Spark, and he likes her too much." I've noticed that he likes her. In truth, I'd noticed that almost all the crew liked her. Ant had regarded her as a rival at first, and Brashen had shouted at the girl more than once for being reckless in her efforts to show herself the better sailor. But that competition had dissolved into a solid friendship. Spark was lively, friendly, capable and hard-working. She wore her dark curly hair in a thick unruly braid now, and her bare feet were calloused from racing down the deck and up the rigging. The sun had baked her as dark as polished wood, and the work had muscled her arms. She glowed with health and good fellowship, and Kennetson's eyes followed her as she worked, and he almost always managed to sit across from her at the galley table. "Everyone's noticed it," Lant replied darkly.
"And that's a problem?"
"It isn't. Yet."
"But you think it will be?"
He gave me an incredulous look.
"Don't you? He's a prince, accustomed to getting anything he wants. And he's the son of a rapist."
"He isn't his father," I said quietly, but could not deny the lurch of anxiety his words woke in me. I asked the next question carefully. "Is Spark worried by it? Did she ask you for protection?" He paused before he answered.
"No, not yet. I don't think she sees the danger, but I don't want to wait for something bad to happen."
"So are you asking me to intervene?" He jabbed his needle through the heavy folded canvas.
"No, I just want you to know before something happens. So maybe you would back me, if it comes to that."
"It won't come to that," I said quietly. He turned to look at me, wide-eyed. "If you are wise, you will do nothing until Spark asks for your protection. She isn't the sort of girl who runs and hides behind a man. If there's a difficulty, she should be able to handle it. And I think the quickest way for you to make her angry would be to interfere before she's asked for any help. If you want, I'll speak to the captains about it. This is their ship to keep order on. I know you have feelings for Spark, but..."
"Enough. I'll do as you suggest."
He bit the words off and then began sewing with some ferocity. For the rest of that day, I watched Spark and Kennetson. There was no denying he was aware of her and that she possibly enjoyed it. I did not see her flirting with him, but she laughed at his jokes, and I could see how Lant, constrained by both honor and duty, might chafe to see it. It made me both weary and envious of their youth. How many years had it been since I had felt the stabs of jealousy and the painful doubts of loving someone I could not claim? It was both a relief to be free of such turmoil and a reminder of the years that I carried on my shoulders. I teetered on the edge of interfering. I tried to decide if I should have a private conversation with Spark, but feared that would seem more like a rebuke to her. And if I spoke to Prince Kennetson, I wondered how he would react. If his attention was but a friendly flirtation, I'd feel like a meddling fool. And if he had genuine feelings for Spark, I imagined he would react as I had when Lady Patience had tried to warn me away from Molly. The situation was complicated even more by my growing friendship with the young man. His pride still made him prickly, but it was evident that he was doing his best to become a solid sailor. He had become more adept at scrubbing out his own garments and generally tending to the tasks that servants had performed for him since his birth, though he was still uncertain of whether the crew was mocking him or joking with him when someone included him in a jest. His pride was a high wall for him to batter through, but he was trying. More than once now, I had slipped the butterfly cloak from its storage and ghosted the deck beneath it. On a ship where there was precious little privacy, it gave me a tiny hidden space where I could sit and no one would tread on me. I was ignored by all. My lengthy time as Shade Spy had eroded forever all guilt I might feel at being a party to other people's conversations, but I did not deliberately seek them out on the ship. Ant's close friendship with our Divitown navigator was certainly not my business, nor did I attempt to hear the morose conversations between Althea and Brashen on the aft deck. On the evening, when I found my usual quiet place occupied by two of the Divitown sailors having a smoke, I drifted forward soundlessly toward the foredeck. I halted what I hoped was a safe distance away and felt mild alarm to see Kennetson stretched full length on the deck. I took two more cautious steps and could see that his eyes were closed, but his chest was rising and falling in the slow and steady rhythm of someone in a deep sleep. Paragon spoke as softly as a parent by a sleeping child's bed.
"I know you're there."
"I supposed you might," I said as softly.
Come closer. I'd like to talk to you.
Thank you, but I think I'd best talk to you from here.
As you wish.
I nodded silently. I hunkered down on the deck, my back to his railing, leaned my head back, and looked up at the stars.
What?
The ship demanded. He had crossed his arms and was looking over his shoulder at me. His face was so like mine, as it had been in those years, that I wasn't sure if I were talking to him or myself.
Once, a long time ago, I tried to walk away from everything, from my family, from my duty. For a time it seemed to make me happy, but it didn't really.
You are referring to me restoring myself, to becoming the two dragons who have been trapped in this wood for six of your generations.
Yes.
You think I will be unhappy?
I don't know. I just think that you might want to reconsider. You have a family. You are loved. You are...
I am trapped.
I was too, but
I do not intend to remain a ship. Save your breath, human.
After a moment, he added,
You may resemble me, but I am not you. My circumstances are completely different, and I did not ask to wake to this servitude.
I thought of saying that I'd never desired the role my family had demanded of me. And I wondered if I had. I watched Kennetson's chest rise and fall slowly. Very slowly. I started to go down on one knee beside him, but the ship spoke.
He's fine. Don't wake him.
The small charm engraved with his father's profile lay in the hollow of his neck, the fine silver chain pressed firmly against his flesh. I thought of how much I'd dislike having anything that snug around my throat.
It doesn't bother him,
Paragon told me.
Can it speak to him? Why do you care? It's nothing to do with you.
It might be.
Tread carefully, Fitz.
I tried to wonder if discussing it with the ship were less volatile than bringing it up to Althea. I drew a careful breath. There is a young woman on your deck named Spark. She is under my protection. The ship gave a snort of disdain.
I know her. She pleases me, and she scarcely needs your protection.
She's very capable, but I don't wish to see her forced into circumstances where she has to defend herself. If it came to that, I don't think it would go well for Kennetson.
What are you implying?
The ship demanded, and I felt the sudden press of his mind against my defenses. I thickened my walls too late. The ship's upper lip lifted in what was almost a wolfish snarl.
You think so little of him?
I've never heard anyone deny what his father did to Althea, and the wizard wood charm he wears is filled with his father's thoughts. Why should I not be concerned?
Because he is not his father. He does not carry his father's memories.
The ship paused and added ominously,
I carry them. I took them so that no one else would have to bear them.
And then I was thrown face down on the rough wood of the deck. The skin was torn from my palms and knees by the impact. I tried to rise, but a man's weight was suddenly on my back, his thick forearm like a bar of iron against my throat. I struggled to rise, but he was bigger than me, and heavier. His beard rasped against the side of my face, and his voice was a growl as he said,
Such a tender little bit of man-flesh you are. Buck as you will, I'll tame you. I relish a lively ride.
A hand gripped the hair on top of my head and pressed my face down against the wood. I tried to seize his arm and take it away from my throat, but the thick embroidered sleeves of his shirt slipped and slid in my grasp. I tried to scream, but I could not get any air. I braced my palms on the deck and tried to throw his body off mine. I heard another man laugh as the man on top of me pressed himself against me. As the forearm across my windpipe cut off all air and sparks floated in darkness before my eyes, I felt with horror what he intended for me. I snapped back to awareness of myself as Fitz. I dropped my hands from gripping at a forearm that didn't exist. I was panting with a boy's fear and outrage. I staggered to my feet. I was furious and affronted and full of a black fear I could not vanquish.
Never again,
I vowed, and then became completely myself. Not my pain, not my fury and shame.
Kennetson knows nothing of that.
The ship went on softly, as if the storm of memories had never been.
Don't leave, Buckman. Stay where you are, and I'll share a bit more of Kennet's youth with you. I've plenty of that. Plenty of hours of him crawling, torn and bleeding, to where Igrot could not reach him. Nights of fever racking his body, days when his eyes were swollen to slits from the beatings. Let me share with you some of my wonderful family memories.
I felt sickened, but it only increased my outrage. If that was done to him, how could he bear to pass it on? How could he stand to become the same sort of monster?
Interesting that another human does not understand it any more than I do. Perhaps it was his only way to be rid of it, to not be the victim by becoming the victor. You cannot imagine the ways he fought the monsters that assailed his dreams, how he struggled to become everything that Igrot was not. Igrot pretended the finesse of a gentleman sometimes. It was a facade, and I've no idea where it came from. The things he forced that boy to do and be, Kennet never understood. To dress as a fine little man in a lace shirt and serve Igrot at table, just so the pirate could later batter him and rip the garments from his body. Kennet was the one who took a hatchet to my face. Did you know that? I held him in my hands as he did it. Igrot laughed as he chopped my eyes away. It was our bargain. Kennet would blind me, and Igrot would not rape him again. But Igrot never kept his word to anyone about anything. But we did. Oh, how we kept the promises we made in the dark and bloody nights.
I heard the ship grind his teeth together. The wave of emotions that assailed me made my heart thunder and my breath come short. I wondered that Althea and Brashen did not come running. The ship spoke to my thought.
Oh, they guess and suspect, but they do not know all that happened on my decks. Neither are they privy to our conversation now. All those years, with my body trapped as a ship and my mind trapped as a battered boy. Until the day we killed them.
He poisoned them all, with chips of my face ground and mixed into their soup. And when they were all sickened, all grovelling and clasping their bellies and too weak to stand, Kennet finished them. With the same hatchet he'd used to take my eyes, he took their lives. One by one, and their blood and memories soaked into my decks. Every man who had watched him, shamed and humiliated, felt that hatchet. And Igrot, last of all. So
lovingly, he dismembered him. So I have all those memories too, Buckman. He stopped speaking for a time. He turned his back to me and stared out over the water.
Can you imagine, human, to have a young creature you love endure such things as you stand helplessly by, unable to kill his tormentor without killing him? Over and over I took his memories. Twice I took his death and held him safe until he could bear to return to his body again. I could dim those memories for him, but I could not erase them.
His voice became oddly distant, as if he spoke of events that had happened 100 years ago. Kennet could not bear to keep those memories. He would have had to kill himself. So he killed me instead. We agreed to it. I no more wanted to live with the memories than he did. We killed them all, one by one, and Ygrot, last of all. Then Kennet gathered a fine share of the loot that was on board, scuttled me, and watched from the ship's boat as I listed and took on water and finally capsized and sank. I tried to die. I thought I would die. But I do not need air, and I do not need food. I hung there, upside down, under the water. The waves pushed me about, and then a current caught me. And when I realized it was bearing me home, back to Bingtown, I let it. And so eventually they found me, hull up in the mouth of Bingtown Harbor, a hazard to navigation. They dragged me in to a beach, pulled me up out of reach of the tides, and chained me there. The mad ship. The pariah. And there, Brash and Trowel, and Amber, and Althea found me. There were stars in the clear night sky above us, and he cut smoothly through the waves, propelled by a light but constant wind. We could have been the only two living things in the world. The young man stretched on the deck had not moved, and I wondered if Paragon held him under, immersed in sleep. I wondered how much of this tale he would share with Kennetson, and why he had shared it with me.
I will give him none of it, the ship told me. When I go as dragons, it will all go with me.
Do you think the human memories will vanish when you become your dragons?
No,
he spoke with certainty.
The memories of dragons and the recall of the serpents that go between the egg and the dragon are what make us whole. We forget nothing, not if we are properly cased and hatched. I will shake off this ship's body and the shape of your flesh, but always I will carry with me the horror of what humans can do to one another for amusement.
I found I had little to say to that. I looked down on the sleeping young man. So he will never know what his father went through?
He knows enough of it. What little Etta and Wintrow and Sorcor knew, he knows. He need not bear the actual memories. Why should he know more of it than that?
To understand what his father did?
Oh, does knowing what the child Kennet endured make you understand what the man Kennet did?
I listened to my heart beating.
No. Nor I. Nor would he. So why burden him with it?
Perhaps so he would never do likewise.
That bit of dragon womb the lad wears strapped to his throat, carved in his father's likeness, was worn by his mother for many more years than Kennet. She spent her childhood as a whore
Can you conceive that she thought of Kennet as the first person to treat her with kindness? That she came to love him for saving her from that life? I did not know, I said quietly. Believe me, Kennetson knows more of rape than he would care to admit, and I doubt he will perpetuate upon others what his mother regards with abhorrence. He took in air and sighed it out, a sound like waves on fine sand. Perhaps that was why his mother bound it so tightly about his throat before she allowed him to board. Kennetson stirred. He rolled over, opened his eyes, and stared wordlessly up at the sky. I held my breath and stood motionless. The cloak was not a perfect protection. It took on the texture and color and seeming dimension of whatever was behind me, but the wind was ruffling it, and I suspected that would look peculiar. Still, he did not look toward me. He spoke to the sky, or the ship.
I should have been born on these decks. I should have grown up here. I've missed so much.
We both have, Paragon replied. His voice was kindly. There is no going back, my son. We will take what we have now and keep it with us forever.
When you turn into dragons, you will leave me.
Yes, Kennetson sighed.
You didn't even have to think about it.
Any other answer would be impossible.
Will you come back to visit, or will you just be gone forever?
That I don't know. How can I possibly know? Kennetson sounded very young as he asked,
Well, what do you hope you will do?
I think I will have to relearn how to be a dragon, and there will be two of us, me and yet not me. I cannot speak for what happens after. I can only say that for the days we have left together, I will be here with you. I ghosted away. That conversation was not for me. I had enough pain of my own without hearing another child abandoned by a father. I had stayed too long with the figurehead. It might be that both Amber and Spark would be sleeping. I moved across the deck in a series of pauses, avoiding the crew. In the dark of the companionway, I stood outside the door and silently removed the cloak. I gave it a shake and carefully folded it. I tapped lightly on the door three times. No one spoke, so I eased it open. The fool was supine on the floor. A faint light came in the porthole, just enough to distinguish him there.
Fitz!
He greeted me amiably. I looked down at him and then at the upper bunk. No Spark?
On duty tonight. So, the butterfly cloak again?
How did you know?
I heard the snap of fabric outside the door. I guessed it was the cloak, and you just confirmed it. Where were you spying?
I wasn't. It's one way to be alone, to be invisible, even when there are others nearby. But I did spend some time with Paragon.
That's a dangerous pastime. Stand clear, please.
I moved until my back touched the door. He brought his knees quickly up to his chest and attempted to vault to his feet. He failed, crashing sideways into the bunk with a force that would leave bruises. He made not a squeak at the pain. Instead, he slowly stood and then sat on the bunk.
Not quite able to do that yet, but I will.
I know you will, I said. If will alone could make a thing be, the fool could master his old tumbler's tricks. I pulled my old pack out from under the bed. Reaching inside, I found the Elderling firebrick and made sure it was upright before I tucked the folded cloak beside it. I reached past my folded clothing and Bee's books. The tubes of silver I felt through the shirt wrapping them. Shade's exploding pots in the very bottom. As I resettled everything securely, I asked lightly, "Any more dreams, fool?" He made a dismissive sound. A moment later he said,
"I should have known that Paragon would be aware of my dreams. What did he tell you?"
"Nothing about what you dream, but he did share with me, in an impressively vivid manner, a bit of what shaped Kennet." I wedged my pack back under the bunk in an upright position and sat down beside the fool. I had to bow my head to fit. What monsters humans are. I'd rather be a wolf. He surprised me by suddenly leaning on me.
"Me too."
After a moment, he added,
"I'm sorry. I've been angry with you. That wasn't fair. But it also wasn't fair for you to doubt my dreams. Have you touched minds with B again?"
"No. I've tried several times, but I can't find her. I must be so careful. Shade is out there, raging like a storm. Twice he has come at me, demanding I join him. At first I sensed Nettle there too, and the coterie, trying to bring him under control, to confine him to his body. The last time, I didn't sense them at all, but if Shade is pursuing me and B gets caught up in that, it might very well burn out her abilities. She was very tentative, and I pushed her away. I know I confused her." I stopped. That was enough for him to know. My pain and shame were my own.
"You didn't tell me any of that."
"You were angry." I paused. "So, your turn. What did you dream?" He was quiet. I tried to keep my voice light. "I suppose we both die, again." He drew in a deep breath, and his gloved hand sought my wrist.
"I don't want to sleep, Fitz. I sit up here in the bunk, in the dark both day and night, and I try not to sleep, because I don't want to dream. But I do, and the urge to speak the dreams, to write them down, is so strong it makes me ill. But I cannot write them down, for I've not enough sight, even if I had ink, and I don't want to tell them to anyone."
"Not telling the dreams makes you sick?"
"It's like an obsession. The true dreams must be spoken and shared, at the very least written down."
He laughed low.
"The servants count on that. They harvest the dreams of those poor half-whites like farmers harvesting grapes. Everything goes into their library of dreams and predictions. All is processed, like blowing the chaff from grain. All is preserved, referenced and cross-referenced, ready for them to employ, to see what they can predict and how they can profit from it."
He leaned in hard to me like a child fleeing nightmares, and I put my arm around him to brace him. He shook his head.
"Fitz, they will know we are coming. They have B, and they will know we are coming. This can't end well for any of us."
"So tell me, don't let me go into this blind." He choked out a laugh.
"Oh, no. I'm the one who goes into it blind, Fitz. You die. You drown. In darkness, in cold seawater, and in blood, you drown. There. Now you know. I don't know what good it does us, but you know."
I felt his shoulders slump in the dimness.
"And I have the small relief of having told my dreams."
Cold crept through me. My mouth might claim not to believe him, but my guts did. "Couldn't I freeze to death?" I asked in a falsely light voice. "I've heard that you just fall asleep and it's done."
"Sorry,"
he said, and I heard the same effort in his voice.
"I don't get to decide how it happens. I'm simply told it does.
And you?
That's the worst part. I think I live through it.
I had a moment of relief. Then it died. He was not certain of his survival. And B? My voice shook. I know you've dreamed her alive. Do we save her? Does she go home? He spoke, hesitantly.
I think she is like you. She is a crossroads of many possible futures. I've seen her wearing a crown with alternating spires of flame and darkness. But she also appears as broken manacles, one who frees things, and as the shattered vessel.
What is the shattered vessel?
Something broken, beyond repair,
he said quietly. My child, Molly's daughter, broken, beyond repair. Some part of me had known that her experience must do that to her. She would be as broken as the fool and I were. Something inside my chest hurt at the thought. My voice creaked. Well, who wouldn't break? I broke. You broke.
And we both emerged.